This episode of the Inner Ho Uprising is sponsored by you. That is right, you. All of your Patreon donations, PayPal donations, five-star reviews on Apple and Stitcher, shout-outs on social media, articles, mentions to your friends, IHU merchandise purchases, all make the show possible week in and week out. For that, we thank you very much, homies. This episode of the Inner Ho Uprising is also available for your viewing pleasures on YouTube. If looking at people while they podcast is your thing, then you can click the YouTube link in our show notes and gaze along as we talk our shits. Welcome to the Inner Ho Uprising, the podcast about sex, love, and dating from the perspective of me, Sam, one black, non-monogamous, pansexual feminist ho who lives in New York City, who is double-cheeked up, double-masked up, and double-unvaccinated, unfortunately, but one day, whose pronouns are she and her. And this week, it is just me by myself, which if you listen to the show, I'm sure you're cool with since I've hosted every single episode of the podcast. But if not, then I apologize. And we have like 200 other episodes that you can listen to. But I suggest that you listen to this one because I think it'll be pretty good. So Rodeca, my co-host for today, couldn't make it because she's actually feeling under the weather. So wish her a speedy recovery on the social medias and stuff like that. But on this episode, I'll be talking solo a little bit about the Atlanta massacre that happened last week, targeting Asian massage parlors. Then I'll be doing a quick contextual explainer about race, gender, fetishization, sex work, and law enforcement, and how all of these things tie into what happened in that massacre. And we'll wrap up with an Ask Media about some very vulgar showgirls. So that should be a more fun section of the show. So if you would like to follow along with the conversation had in this podcast on social media, you can do so by using the hashtag Inner Ho Uprising so that we can see it on social media. You can use the hashtag PodIn so that other people who search the hashtag can see what you're listening to. That in the case being Inner Ho Uprising. And if you would like to follow us on social media, you can do so by going to at Inner Ho Uprising, that's without the G on Twitter because of character limits, and at Inner Ho Uprising on Instagram and Facebook. And if you're on Facebook, why not join our Facebook community by searching Inner Ho Uprising Community, that is spelled C-U-M-M-U-N-I-T-Y because we love cum puns on this here show. And you can also head to innerhouprising.com to figure out how to pay a ho. Let us begin with our first segment of the day, and as always, it's one of my favorite bumps.
Grandma, yeah. Are you a hoe?
Are you a hoe is the question that we must ask. And the answer is yes, if you're one of the Inner Ho Uprising Hoes of the Week. So Ho of the Week is where we shout out the homies who have paid Inner Ho Uprising in the past week. Hoes of the Week get special nicknames, and the game, if they choose to participate, is to guess the meaning behind their nickname. This week we have Quinn, a.k.a. Hogendorfer, who became a patron on Patreon, and one of my faves, Jason, a.k.a. Basin, a.k.a. Vorheezy, a.k.a. the King of Karaoke, who paid a hoe this week. Thank you very much to both of you. Cool. So now we're going to get into the actual show with a segment that we call Fuck That. Fuck That is a segment where we talk about current events in the world that pertain to sex, love, dating, gender, race, and all those kinds of things. And this week is a bit of a somber one because this week was a bit of a somber week. Today we're going to talk about the Atlanta massacre and solidarity with Asian sex workers. So we're going to start off by talking about what happened in Atlanta and providing a little bit more context on sex work, racism, fetishization — that is a hard word to pronounce — fetishization, and the push to decriminalize sex work, and a lot more. So just to give a quick rundown of what happened in Atlanta on March 16th, 2021, that's last week, a series of mass shootings occurred at three spas or massage parlors in Atlanta, Georgia. Eight people were killed, six of whom were Asian women, and one other person was wounded. The gunman — I don't really want to say his name, so I'm not going to — was taken into custody later that day. This shooting is especially notable because it has happened during a current rising in anti-Asian sentiment in the United States during the COVID-19 pandemic. So the victims of the shooting were Delania Ashley Gonzalez, who's 33, was on a date at Young Asian Spa and with her husband, who she married in August, the mother of a 14-year-old son and a 9-month-old daughter, and had worked at Waffle House just a few doors down from the spa. There's Paul Andre Michels, who was 54. Michels was a local business owner who had been married over 2 decades. Family members described him as a hardworking Army veteran who owned an electric company. And there's Sha Oji Tan. Sha Oji Tan owned Young's Asian Massage and at least one other spa. She was described by a close friend as the sweetest person you'd ever meet. Then there is Dao Yu Fang, 44. Little is known about Fang at this time. She worked at Young's Asian Massage, according to a coworker, and relatives could not be reached for comment, according to NBC News. Then there is Hyun Jung Grant, 51. Hyun Jung Grant was a Korean immigrant who worked at Gold Spa. Her son, Randy Park, was quoted saying, "She wasn't just my mother, she was my friend." Then there is Soon Cha Kim, 69. Kim worked at Gold Spa and in her spare time enjoyed line dancing, a family member told the New York Times. She was a grandmother, married more than 50 years. She immigrated to Korea from Korea to the United States to provide a better education and better life. Then there was Soon Chung Park, who was 74. Park worked alongside Grant and Kim at Gold Spa. Park lived in New York before moving to Atlanta. Her son-in-law told the New York Times, "She got along with her family so well," he said in Korean. Then there is Yang A. Yu, who was 63. Yu worked at Aromatherapy Spa across the street from Gold Spa. She was born in South Korea. She met her husband, Mac Peterson, who was stationed in the U.S. Army there. They moved to the United States in the 1970s, and at one point were living in Fort Benning, Georgia, before their divorce in 1982. They had 2 sons together, and their families remained close. And then the person who was wounded was Alicias Hernandez Ortiz. He is 30. Hernandez Ortiz's wife, Flor Gonzalez, told the New York Times he called her after being wounded by the gunman steps away from Young's Asian Massage. She said her husband had been hospitalized with multiple gunshot wounds. Hernandez Ortiz is a mechanic and migrated from Guatemala 10 years ago, and the two have been married just as long. His wife is quoted stating, "He is still alive. He's fighting for his life. But the doctors told me he will have a long recovery after he leaves the hospital," she added through tears. "Many others died and my heart breaks for them. Whoever did this is not human." So before transitioning into the element of this segment that focuses on sex work and migrant sex workers, I want to hold space for the fact that these people who were targeted were Asian women, perceived to be sex workers and potentially sex workers, we're not sure yet, working class and largely older. So I just want to say you cannot remove any of those identities from this picture. People at these margins, as well as with many other kinds of marginalized people, have largely been looked over, received heightened abuse, and not received social support during this pandemic. So let's talk about why we can't, when it comes to this massacre, can't just discuss race, just discuss gender, or just discuss profession here. And that really goes with anything that you're talking about. I heard earlier today on a podcast someone say, this mass shooting didn't happen in a vacuum, but no mass shooting happens in a vacuum. So we're going to start with a quote from Esther Cao of Red Canary Song. Red Canary Song is a New York City-based grassroots collective of Asian and migrant sex workers organizing transnationally. So Cao is quoted saying, "There is this assumption that all these massage parlor workers are sex workers. That may or may not be the case. The majority of massage parlors are licensed businesses that also provide professional non-sexual massages. Yet..." That's my yet to kind of bridge these two sentences. But there's this assumption of sexuality and fetishization of Asian women's bodies that is unique to this kind of crime, Cao said, end quote. So there's a long history of tropes of hypersexualized Asian women in American media. Some recent examples in my brain, and you can comment or email us with examples in your brain. And I was going to ask Rebecca, but she's not here. But some recent examples in my brain are like Fook Me and Fook You, like the hypersexualized Asian twins from Austin Powers. That whole thing was like Austin Powers is like hypersexualizing women, but I guess it's making fun of how women are hypersexualized in like the Bond films and stuff like that. But I never watched the Bond films, so that was what came to my brain. There's like the parlor scenes in Rush Hour. There's all of Childish Gambino's old discography. This is a little bit older, but Full Metal Jacket is another one that stood out to me. And then there's also just the fact that, like, I see things like this on 90 Day Fiancé. Sex tourism that specifically sees waves of white American and other white Western men hitting up Asian countries for sex specifically. And with this idea that the women are going to be both sexual and submissive. So despite these somewhat recent examples, this has actually been in American consciousness for a very long time. So in the 19th century, there was this immigration law called the Page Act of 1875. It was the first restrictive federal immigration law in the United States, which effectively prohibited the entry of Chinese women. So this is actually before what you might have remembered from history class, the Chinese Exclusion Act. And before this, there was open borders. So before the Page Act, like, anybody could get into the country. And the very first instance of people being limited from entering this country was specifically targeted at Chinese women for their sexuality. So this law was named after its sponsor, a dude named Representative Horace F. Page, who was a Republican representing California, who introduced the bill to, quote unquote, end the danger of cheap Chinese labor and immoral Chinese women. The law technically barred immigrants considered, quote unquote, undesirable, and defined like a couple of types of immigrants. And in that description of types included any East Asian woman who would engage in prostitution. So only, like, it had different kinds of bans, but only the ban on female East Asian immigrants was effectively and heavily enforced and proved to be a barrier for all East Asian women trying to immigrate, especially Chinese women. The Page Act created the policing of immigrants around sexuality, which gradually became extended to every immigrant who sought to enter America, and today remains a central feature of immigration restriction, according to some scholars. So I just want to, like, make a quick tangent. This is, like, not a highly funded narrative podcast. Everything that we do is pretty much produced in 4 days, if not 3 days. So I didn't have much time to go into the entire history of the Page Act. And if you know way more about the Page Act than me, or something that I'm saying is not accurate, please feel free to write into this podcast. But I want to make a quick tangent on the Page Act, because it is said to have been enforced because these women were in servitude, like, that it was the quote unquote justification for it. I don't know who ever validated that or how valid that actually is because of misconceptions around voluntary sex workers. And I said voluntary, not involuntary just now. Misconceptions around voluntary sex workers being perceived as trafficked, which is something that happens to this day. So I don't know if that was, like, a myth being placed on women immigrating to the United States, or if they were actually in servitude. But I think that that deeply plays a role with what we see later when it comes to how sex work is perceived against migrants, Asian migrants, and just in general. Okay, so here's why I think the Page Act is super relevant. Today, mainstream media often suggests that these mass shooters are, like, one-off people with hateful ideologies, and that they seemingly got these ideologies from out of the sky. But the majority of the time, they're just a reflection of how this white supremacist patriarchal country paints marginalized people in the first place. So there's a reason why queer people, women, Black people, other kinds of people of color, and migrants are often the targets of these attacks. There's a reason why most mass shooters have a history of violence against women. His brain didn't make, and him, I'm referring to the shooter in this Atlanta massacre, his brain didn't tell him that these women were dangerous, temptress harlots like his country has been telling him, his ancestors, their ancestors that for, like, the past 200 years and still do. So the Page Act was repealed in 1943, but anti-immigrant and anti-sex work sentiments live on heavily. And I mean, you can see that in the coverage for this story, because I've seen, like, a lot of places talk about, or I've heard a lot of places talk about the element of this that can be a hate crime attributed to race, which absolutely should not be removed from this. But I see very few people talking about the fact that these people were targeted because they were perceived to be sex workers, and then not even going further enough to talk about how that harms sex workers who are also Asian migrant women. It's like people want to, like, eliminate sex workers from this conversation, which I think is very harmful. Yeah, I also want to say that many of those sentiments are linked to notions about Asian American women that were widespread during times of war, like the Korean and Vietnam War. And then that also kind of shuffled its way into American media, like how I mentioned Full Metal Jacket before, which is a movie about the Vietnam War, but it was made in the 80s. So that's another piece of this. So let's talk about the lived experiences of Asian folks who work in both illicit and non-illicit massage parlors. So there are parlors, as I mentioned, or as the quote mentioned earlier from Esther Cao of Red Canary Song, about how not all massage parlors offer illicit massage. So it's estimated that there are 9,000 parlors that do offer illicit massage. I'm personally uncertain of the accuracy of this, since sex work is criminalized and places aren't just like, hey, we offer illicit massage. So I think that's going to kind of skew the numbers a little bit. So like, yeah, numbers do matter for sure. But I also want to note that whether a parlor does or does not offer sexual massage, sex work shouldn't be criminalized. Like it does. Like I'm not even ranking these things morally or anything like that. Like it just shouldn't be criminalized anywhere. And then also like bringing up the fact that parlors that do offer massage are already linked to sex work under the gaze of white supremacist whorephobic patriarchy, which could have been the case in one, if not all three, of these spas. So as with all forms of labor, people do work in illicit massage parlors for a number of different reasons. So that can range from anything like they make more money than other jobs available to them, their other workplaces were harsh or abusive or underpaying, they might just like to provide pleasure and sensual touch to people, and working in these kinds of places allows for that to happen. So there is, though, this misconception in mainstream media, amongst law enforcement, and amongst like these weird ass paternalistic nonprofits, that the majority of people who work in these kinds of parlors are victims of sex trafficking. So there's actually very little evidence to support that claim, and people who are in the industry tend to report otherwise. So I'm about to read a quote from Emily, who is an Asian parlor worker who was quoted in a Vice article called "Massage Parlors with Happy Endings Give These Sex Workers a Decent Living." So Emily said, "We're not sex slaves, and nobody I've talked to or worked with is a sex slave by any means." She actually wrote this to the author of that piece. Most of my coworkers are immigrants, yes, but honestly, they're in it for the money, and they make more money doing this than working in a restaurant washing dishes or in a dry cleaner's folding laundry. Emily said she sees about 4 to 8 clients a day and charges $120 for full service, $40 for a hand job, $80 for a blow job, plus her additional $100 salary from the spa. I'm assuming that's per day, but I'm not sure, and it wasn't verified in the article. Back to the quote. She has made more than $200,000 over 3 years during the work part-time while in college. According to her own numbers, Emily is making 60% more per year than the average non-sexual massage therapist, who, per the Bureau of Labor Statistics, brings in about $41,000 a year. The article then goes on to say the notion that most or almost all of the women in these parlors are trafficked when they work in massage parlors is completely bogus. So that's a quote from Dr. Ronald Weitzer, a professor of sociology at George Washington University and an expert in sex work and sex trafficking. And then he goes on to say there's no data to support that. So a little bit more from that article. Some sex workers and scholars have argued that police and nonprofits inflate the scope of sex trafficking as a problem so that they can look like heroes swooping in to quote unquote save consensual sex workers from so-called slavery. Law enforcement argue they are helping victims, while sex workers say police are the ones who are victimizing them. So yeah, that's what I was trying to get at earlier with the quote unquote justification of the PAGE Act. Like, since this is something that most sex workers talk about and complain of today, with their profession being conflated with sex trafficking, like, I'm just not sure if that was actually what was going on during the time that the PAGE Act was passed, but I wouldn't be surprised because it's had such a long history in this country. But if I'm wrong, I'm very open to people telling me that I'm wrong. So let's talk about the safety of these massage parlor workers. Their safety is largely in jeopardy due to the criminalization of sex work and the consequences that criminalization has on people in these parlors, whether they are engaging in sex work or just perceived to be doing so. So here's a quote from an article in The Cut called "Everyday Massage Parlor Workers Face Violence." It was written kind of like in response to this Atlanta massacre. And the quote is from interviewee Elaine Lam, or Alini Lam, the executive director of Butterfly, which is a Toronto-based support network for Asian and migrant sex workers. So Aline said, law enforcement and the criminalization of sex work are also killing women by taking away their means of survival and making their work more dangerous. In many Canadian and U.S. cities, massage workers are not allowed to lock the doors to their rooms, which puts their safety at risk. One woman, Angel, told me about how a group of men kicked open her door, pointed a gun to her head, robbed and sexually assaulted her. Then there's the criminalization of third-party workers like the owners and the managers of these parlors, which means that violent behavior goes unreported and clients aren't screened properly. End quote. So I have a stat from a study of 100 Korean and Chinese folks who work in illicit massage in the illicit massage industry that stated that 40% of people interviewed reported that a client forced them to have sex, while 18% said a client hit them or physically hurt them. So one of the major reasons why the criminalization of sex work hurts sex workers is because they can't report or seek safety when their lives are at risk for a fear of getting arrested or abused by the cops. The risk is even greater if you're an undocumented migrant sex worker because you also face things like detainment and deportation. And also the criminalization of sex work makes it easy for cops and paternalistic organizations to conflate sex work with sex trafficking. So let's talk about why this conflation is dangerous. So I'm going to quote an info sheet from Butterfly, that same organization that I mentioned a few seconds ago. The sheet is called Understanding Migrant Sex Workers, Migration Plus Sex Work Does Not Equal Trafficking. So it reads, conflating human trafficking with sex work or focusing solely on human trafficking and imposing this framework onto migrant sex workers can have extremely harmful effects for migrant sex workers. Sex work is wrongly recognized as trafficking and third parties as traffickers. An approach that assumes sex work is inherently exploitative limits the understanding of the diversity of migrant sex workers' lives and realities and the complexities of their needs and concerns. When only sex itself is seen as exploitation, actual instances of exploitation in the workplace are not recognized, and workers are prevented from improving their working conditions and accessing labor protections. Migrant sex workers are also targeted by surveillance and raids. It does not only obstruct migrant sex workers' access to safety, protection, and support, it also increases their vulnerability to violence and exploitation. Raid and rescue, for example, Operation Northern Spotlight, which is a method of rescuing people from sex trafficking in Canada, is being used to identify and quote unquote identify and quote unquote rescue victims by law enforcement. The aim of anti-trafficking initiatives is claimed to protect people who are exploited or trafficked. However, 23 migrant sex workers connected with Butterfly were arrested and deported as a result of trafficking investigations. That didn't protect or rescue them from anything. Just put them in more harm's way. So yeah, this conflation is putting more folks at risk based on little evidence that trafficking is even occurring. So just putting people at risk for no real reason. And then there's this notion that goes out into the world that sex workers, particularly migrant sex workers, need rescuing. So this notion of rescuing and moral concern when it comes to Asian migrant sex work also has a long history. Like I said, with it being the foundation of the PAGE Act, which I'm still unclear about. And then there's this quote from 1885 from the Special Committee of the Board of Supervisors of San Francisco who were investing Chinese immigration, who said, "We have shown that Chinese prostitution exists among us as the basis of the abject and satanic conception of human slavery." And I just think the word satanic being used in regards to Chinese migrants is very interesting. Like, it's this sort of like, and I'm going to use this phrase a little bit later because it's also quoted in Butterfly, but it's like this sort of moral panic when it comes to others and foreign peoples. And so just a very egregious thing to say about a population of people from people who are in the government from a country where just like 20 years before that quote, slavery was legal. So that's a bit interesting to me. But to quote Butterfly again, sex work is often represented as a crime, as a social nuisance, immoral, inherently wrong, sexual exploitation, and violence against women. The images of trafficked victims and rescuers presented in media or even in anti-trafficking trainings have created a moral panic that induces the desire to rescue sex workers who are described as victims, end quote. So this idea of a moral panic is very striking to me in the context of what happened in Atlanta, because the murderer rooted the murders in this this internal moral strife that he was having due to wanting to watch porn and go to these spas and receive sexual services. When I say go to these spas, I don't mean the specific spas that he targeted. I just mean spas in general, because I'm not sure if those two are the same yet. So I also want to quote an article from the Washington Post about his moral strife, quote unquote, and his relationship to the church. So to paraphrase the first couple of lines from the Washington Post article, basically the murderer and his families were the parishioners of Crab Apple, which is a Southern Baptist church, I guess somewhere in Georgia. Now I'm not going to actually quote the article. So the evangelical congregation's minister, the Reverend Jerry Dockery, is an energetic preacher who advocated for a socially conservative brand of Christianity that, as the church bylaws put it, views adultery, fornication, homosexuality, bisexual conduct, bestiality, incest, polygamy, pedophilia, pornography, or any attempt to change one's sex or disagree with one's biological sex as quote unquote sinful and offensive to God. End his quote, end the quote from the Washington Post. And it's just like very fucking like the fact that gay people and transgender people and people who are polyamorous and bisexual and watch porn are looped into bestiality and like pedophilia. It's fucking egregious. So to me, that quote is so telling of the ways that Christianity is being wielded as a tool for the conservative right in this country. It's not a coincidence that as we see this mass murder in the name of quote unquote sexual purity, we're also seeing a record number of anti-trans pieces of legislation being introduced into state legislation. Right now, at the time I'm recording this, that's a whopping 82 bills and counting, targeting mostly transgender youth. It's not a coincidence that these two things are happening at the same time in this country. It's no surprise that during the 2020 presidential elections, priests across the country were telling their congregations that it's a mortal sin if you don't vote for Trump. That's actually true. I will cite articles in the show notes to like prove backing for that. It's like the goal of this country and the conservative right specifically to keep sex workers, to keep women, to keep queer people, to keep trans people at the bottom rungs of this hierarchical country. And they're equating any and all identities that fall outside of being white, cis, straight, and a man as sinful to do it. So I'm going to continue on this train of thought, but just like a quick tangent, this is what they're trying to do. Like, they're using like the fact that these things are quote unquote sins to fucking oppress people. So every day that you are whorephobic and dismissing the labor of sex workers as like, oh, that shit I'm not going to pay for. I'm going to steal somebody's OnlyFans. Da, 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 da. Every day that you are bringing up debunked pseudobiology to silence trans people, every day that you're playing into these narratives that Black people should like look away from this massacre because of tensions between Black and Asian Americans that largely exist because of white supremacy, like every time you're doing that, you're doing the job of white supremacy. You're doing the job of the patriarchy and you're being a fucking op. And you need to just cut it out. Speaking of ops, another quote from ABC News regarding the targeted massage parlors. Police records released by Atlanta last Friday show that 10 people were arrested at the two Atlanta massage businesses on prostitution charges, but none since 2013. Almost all of the arrests came in undercover stings where an officer paid for a massage and an employee offered sex or a sex act for money. The reports were first obtained by the Washington Post. Moreover, police records show officers were sent on prostitution calls to two of those Atlanta area massage businesses at least 21 times in the past 10 years. Police were called to them repeatedly, end quote. If you are calling the cops on suspected sex workers, you are being a fucking op. Do not do that. These locations that were targeted, this is me talking, the locations that were targeted by the police for years for something that shouldn't even be illegal were eventually the locations of murder by someone who perceived what these women were doing to be wrong. Toxic white male civilian violence mirrors the behavior of the cops because they're both working to uphold that white patriarchal hierarchy that I'm referring to. The same way this guy killed these parlor workers because my country told me sex work is bad is the same way that white vigilantes kill black kids because my country told me black people are criminal. Like, there's a connection there. It's pretty fucking strong. So I say all that to say that no one can open their fucking mouth about this tragedy unless they support decriminalization of sex work and illicit massage parlors right the fuck now. Like, right the fuck now. Because that is a huge reason why this happened. Since we're on the subject of prostitution stings at the hands of the cops, I wanted to hold space for Yang Song. Yang Song, or Song Yang in Chinese name ordering, was a parlor worker in Flushing, Queens, who was killed during a prostitution raid. She fell to her death. Here's a quote from an article by Documented New York. Yang Song moved from China to Flushing with her husband in 2013. She had a temporary green card and dreamed of opening her own spa, but worked first as a waiter and then as a sex worker on 40th Road to support her family. Advocates say her struggles, including multiple arrests and an alleged assault at the hands of a client, reveal the inadequacy of anti-human trafficking strategies that rely on close collaboration with police and courts. The NYPD has the obligation to protect all of its residents. Yang Song's brother, Hei Song, told Documented on Sunday, or the Sunday that this was written, through a translator. However, in the past, when Yang Song was harassed or assaulted by others and went to the police for help, she never received it. When police attempted to arrest Yang Song on the night of November 25th, 2017, she was already facing a December 1st hearing for prostitution-related arrests from September, end quote. So she fell to her death fleeing from the cops for something that should not be criminalized in the first place. Like, I said this on the episode that we did a couple of weeks after the uprisings and stuff back in May, but like, if the decriminalization of sex work isn't like one of your priorities and you're talking about defund the police and stuff like that, then you're just like, you're just missing a huge element of it. So Red Canary Song, the organization that I mentioned at the start of this, was formed in direct response to the death of Yang Song. They started as a project to provide legal support for her family and to help her mother pay for healthcare expenses. Today, they are the only grassroots Chinese massage parlor worker coalition in the United States. I'm going to quote their website. There are over 9,000 workplaces like these across the country with no political representation or access to labor rights or collective organizing. Anti-trafficking NGOs that claim to speak for migrants in sex trades promote increased policing and immigrant control, which harms rather than helps migrant sex workers. We also organize transnationally with Asian sex workers across the diaspora in Toronto, Paris, and Hong Kong, end quote. Red Canary Song wrote an important response to the Atlanta massacre, and I'm going to wrap up this portion of the episode by reading it. So it is titled Red Canary Song's Response to Shootings at Gold Massage Spa, Young's Asian Massage, and Aromatherapy Spa. Subtitled Radical Healing from the State and Community Violence, Mourning with Asian Massage Workers in the Americas. In the wake of the deaths of multiple Asian women massage workers in Georgia, we are sending radical love, care, and healing to all of our community members. We acknowledge the ongoing pain and grief from continued violent assaults on our Asian and Asian American APIA community, which has been compounded by the alienation, isolation, and violence brought on by racist rhetoric and governmental neglect in reaction to the COVID-19 pandemic. We are concerned that many of those calling for action in this movement have and will continue to endorse violence towards Asian sex workers, massage workers, and survivors. We reject the call for increased policing in response to this tragedy. The impulse to call for increased policing is even greater in the midst of rising anti-Asian violence, calling for carceral punishment. We understand the pain that motivates our Asian and Asian American community members for increased policing, but we nevertheless stand against it. Policing has never been an effective response to violence because the police are agents of white supremacy. Policing has never kept sex workers or massage workers or immigrants safe. The criminalization and demonization of sex work has hurt and killed countless people, many at the hands of the police, both directly and indirectly. Due to sexist, racialized perceptions of Asian women, especially those in vulnerable, low-wage work, Asian massage workers are harmed by the criminalization of sex work, regardless of whether they engage in it themselves. Decriminalization of sex work is the only way that sex workers, massage workers, sex trafficking survivors, and anyone criminalized for their survival and/or livelihood will ever be safe. Media coverage that examines the racist or sexist motivations of these killings as independent of each other fail to grasp the deeply connected histories of racialized violence and paternalistic rescue complexes that inform the violence experienced by Asian massage workers. We see the effort to invisibilize these women's gender, labor, class, and immigration status as a refusal to reckon with the legacy of United States imperialism and as a desire to collapse the identities of migrant Asian women, sex workers, massage workers, and trafficking survivors. The women who were killed face specific racialized gendered violence for being Asian women and massage workers. Whether or not they were actually sex workers or self-identified under that label, we know that as massage workers, they were subjected to sexualized violence stemming from a hatred of sex workers, Asian women, working class people, and immigrants. We are asking that the community stand in solidarity with us and all immigrant and migrant massage workers and sex workers. We highlight the following demands from New York-based massage parlor workers. 1, pay attention to the life and work safety of massage and salon employees. 2, Asian massage workers and businesses come from the community and give back to the community. 3, the legal working rights of Asian massage workers must be protected. 4, the lives of Asian massage workers must not be lost in vain. 5, the legal profession of massage work should be respected and protected by U.S. society. Signed, Red Canary Song. So I'm going to be linking that response along with many of the articles I mentioned in this segment. And other relevant resources. I'm going to link in a couple of episodes that we've done on the conflation of sex work and sex trafficking and why that's harmful, episodes that we've done about the decriminalization of sex work, episodes that we've done with Asian American folks, some of which who work in the sex industry, just to open your mind to that perspective a little bit or learn from that perspective a little bit more. I'm going to link to perspectives of Asian American folks, particularly Asian American women, about fetishization and hypersexualization and things like that, all in the show notes. So check those out. And let's wrap up with something a lot lighter than that, but still pretty meaty. One of my favorite segments.
Ass to media, I wanna see you watching ass to media. I wanna see you reading ass to media. I wanna see you hearing ass to media.
Ass to ass.
I wanna see you watching Ask to Media. So Ask Media is the segment where we give book, TV, podcasts, film, sometimes porn reviews that relate to sex, love, dating, and or gender. They are spoiler-free reviews. Typically, this one will be a spoiler-free review. So today, just want to do a quick hit review slash recommendation on this documentary called The Showgirls of Pakistan. I saw this film a couple of weeks ago, and I thought it was pretty relevant since we're already talking about the lived experiences of people who work in the sex industry, particularly folks of Asian descent. So yeah, that's why I want to talk about this one. So here's a synopsis from the International Documentary Film Festival in Amsterdam. And I'm reading this one specifically because I just thought it was a very good synopsis. So Showgirls of Pakistan follows three dancers of mudra, a traditional court entertainment and art form that has been considered vulgar since the British rule introduced Victorian morals to South Asia. Wow. thematic through lines. What do you know? So these are the characters. Afreen mainly dances in theaters, while Uzma's manager sends her to perform at private parties in other countries, such as United Arab Emirates. And after a successful career on stage, Rima, who's a transgender woman, is finding it increasingly difficult to find work. All three of them are confronted by prejudice, strict censorship, and a deeply misogynistic climate. So, Showgirls of Pakistan was directed by Pakistani filmmaker Saad Khan and produced by another Pakistani filmmaker named Anam Abbas. So, I love this film. Some of my favorite elements of it were the fact that it's not a typical documentary about women in a different country who are tangential to sex work, because I don't think these women would consider themselves sex workers. But the work that they're doing is considered, I think, sexually vulgar. So I would say that they are tangential to sex work. But it's not a typical documentary about, like, oh, look at these poor, oppressed women who are being oppressed by religion. It's more so learn about how these women are navigating the patriarchy post-colonialism. Like, that's what this film is to me. And I think it does it pretty well. All the characters are very rich and very badass. And I don't mean rich as in money. I just think they're rich characters. Like, they're full embodied characters. One of my favorite parts about them is that they often curse people out who get in their way. And, like, the cursing used in the film is just so colorful, and it made me laugh on several occasions. So I have some examples. You can play seesaw on my dick, bitches. I'll piss in your sister's cunt. Like, ouch, wow, why would you do that? And just because I dance online doesn't mean I won't fuck you up in person. Like, put that on a t-shirt and I would buy it immediately. So the film makes really fun use of editing and uses, like, low budget Lollywood, which, if you're unfamiliar, is like Pakistani Hollywood, or like in the same vein of Bollywood and Nollywood and things like that. So it uses those kinds of films. It uses social media footage. It uses, like, these flashy showgirl-ish fonts and backgrounds to make up these really, like, artful montages that are cool to see in the film. It's pretty intimate because a lot of the footage is actually from the main character's social media post. So I really enjoyed that element because it even provides more of, like, a, okay, this is people telling their own stories kind of thing. And I straight up, honestly, I just like learning about how people live in subcultures other than my own. And I really appreciate that it is, once again, like, I'm learning this from the people telling me about themselves, as opposed to someone trying to push a narrative down my throat regarding how I should view these people. So you can actually watch this film for free on YouTube on Vice. So this is not a Vice film or a Vice documentary, but Vice is doing this thing where they're distributing documentaries. And this is one of the documentaries that were distributed as a part of that. It's also another documentary called Sakawa Boys, or maybe it's just called Sakawa. Yeah, there's another documentary called Sakawa that I would recommend. That's about scamming amongst people in Ghana, but like a love scamming kind of thing, and using African traditional religion in love scamming. But once again, I felt like it was told very much like not with a particular narrative in mind, and more so just like, let's immerse our viewer into this world about folks. You know, so I recommend that one. I'll link both of them in the show notes. And then a bonus, if you do watch on Vice, the director and the editor of Showgirls of Pakistan, who happen to be partners, drag the fuck out of the paternalistic and white documentary industry. And I live for that. And then also, if you watch Sakawa, the filmmaker also does the talk back. So that's pretty cool. So yeah, I'll link to both of those in the show notes. And that is it for another episode of Inner Ho Uprising. If this episode, I highly doubt it made you laugh. There were not very many funny moments, but I mean, if it did, sure. If it helps you learn something, if it helps you feel good, if it helps you, if it made you question yourself in a good way or positively moved you in any sense, please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher and let everyone you know that you love these hoes. We appreciate every single last one of you. If you'd like to follow us on social media, you can do so by going to @InnerHoeUprising without the G on Twitter, @InnerHoeUprising on Instagram and Facebook. You can join our Facebook group by searching InnerHoeUprising Community. That's CUMMUNITY. I can't sing, so I'm not going to do it like how Rob does it. Dana Owens, please come on, help us out. Queen Latifah. You can also head to InnerHoeUprising.com to pay a hoe if you would like to follow me on social media. I'm pretty much slam rid everywhere. That's rid with two D's. And have a great week, because you motherfucking deserve to. Bye.